For most of us, data is not something that we think about on a daily basis. But imagine if you were to collect information and draw a map of the route that you take to work, to school, or the grocery store. How close are those destinations? And how do you decide which way to go and where to go? That's part of the premise of a new project that runs from March 3rd to April the 9th called the St. Louis Map Room. It's an interactive space open to everyone in the community. It's going to allow you to create your own large map, and it's taking place in the gymnasium of a vacant school in St. Louis. It's a project by COCA, the Center of Creative Arts, and lead designer and digital artist, Jer Thorpe. St. Louis Public Radio data visual specialist, Brent Jones, talked with Thorpe last Friday about the St. Louis Map Room, though they started the conversation with a different project that involves data, that of the 9/11 Memorial in New York City.
Could you describe a little bit about that project and what it does?
I got a strange email out of the blue in 2009 from a friend of a friend who had been working with the team that was putting together the memorial. And one of the central concepts behind the memorial was that the names wouldn't be arranged in alphabetical order, that they would be arranged with no visible order. But they wanted people who had died in the towers, who had a connection during their lives, to be able to be put together. So the easiest example of that would be siblings. And so they came up with this idea. They collected all the requests from next of kin. They called them meaningful adjacency requests. They ended up with a whole bunch of them. So many of them that they realized this was going to be a very hard task. And so there's actually a name for this specific problem and the sort of way that it gets solved in mathematics. They call it the wedding table problem, because it's about how do you arrange people such that they're next to each other in some cases, but then they're not next to each other in others. And so they tried to solve it, the architects, but realized it was going to be a big task. And so they asked me to think about it. I'm not a mathematician, but at the time I'd been doing a lot of work with algorithms and how they can be applied to architecture. So I spent about 3 months working on it and ended up creating an algorithm, actually two algorithms that worked together. I always say that the end product was really a collaboration between the human architects in these algorithms that I developed. I don't know if there's a more human project than the memorial. I think it's like a real foundation of what we are as humans, to want to remember the people we've lost. And so that really changed my thinking, actually, about a lot of the work that I do, because in the past, I think I'd been mostly focused on aesthetic and kind of making pretty things and seeing what computers could do. But that was the first inklings of this idea that data and humans are so deeply entwined.
That's a good example about putting data in public. And that's one of the issues that comes up in the current project that you're working on in St. Louis with COCA, the St. Louis Map Room. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so on March 3rd, we opened the project to the public. It's in an unused public school in Van Deventer. It's called the Stevens School, and we're taking over the auditorium. It's like the gym auditorium, and we're making a space called the Map Room where the community can come and make these really big maps with the help of some robots about their lived experience in the city. And then with those very large maps, we project data on top of it. We have dozens of different data sets that you can project on it. So you might be able to ask, like, well, hey, what did this neighborhood look like in 1916? And we can show you an aerial map of the neighborhood from taken from a balloon. You might ask, like, how did that neighborhood change between 1916 and now? And we can show you a succession of database map showing how the population changed, how income levels changed, how vacancy and real estate patterns changed. We're trying to find some weird ones too, like maps of every tree in the city and underground rivers and streams. And so you can understand the context of this place that you live through the lens of data. And again, you can do it not alone, but in a group. And so community groups and schools primarily will be coming to make these maps. But then anybody, I hope lots of your listeners will come. And you can take down, like, say, a map that was made from a group of 13-year-olds in whatever neighborhood of the city. You can take that map down and start projecting some things on top of it. And you can say, okay, well, maybe this map is how each of the students gets to school in the morning. And then we can overlay traffic patterns on that and say, oh, that's kind of amazing. All these kids are walking to school across this really busy road. Or we can overlay a map of changing income rates and see what that neighborhood looks like now and what it might look like in the future. So it's a chance to look at the state of this city both now and in both directions along the timeline through the lens of the people that live in the city.
Some of this data is going to be available, is already available for people to access. Mm-hmm. How do you think this way of accessing this data or experiencing this data is different from just, say, pulling it up on a website?
Yeah, I mean, all of us could go right now to any variety of websites and kind of see a data map of this city. And the instinctive thing that you would do and that anyone would do is go and find where you live on that map, zoom in and go, oh, okay. So that's one of my problems is that that tends to be the limit of our engagement with civic data, is go find yourself on that map, and then you're done. What this allows you to do is kind of climb into the shoes of hundreds of other St. Louis citizens and see them on the map and their lives on the map and their experience on the map so that you can get many, many, many different ways of experiencing this data. And you might look at a neighborhood that you wouldn't have looked at before. I mean, when I look at a map of the city that I live in, I probably just out of habit, I'm going to focus on the neighborhoods where I live and work. But there's hundreds and thousands of other places to look at. And so that's at the root of it is can we understand this city through your own lived experience, but also through the lived experience of others? And can we get together and talk about maybe some things that are uncomfortable to talk about some of the problems the city is facing, but also about like the hopes for its future and the kind of wonder at its past and to do those things together is the real purpose of the project.
What does the conclusion of this project look like, or what are we going to be left with when it closes?
So three things. 50 maps, 10 by 10 foot maps. We are going to have, I hope, I'll say this on public radio and then it'll happen, right? The maps to be accepted as an official archive of the city so that they will live in the city archive as a document of this time in St. Louis's history. The other thing that we get out of it is a platform. So Map Room, St. Louis is the first place we really conceived this project for St. Louis. Over the last 2 years, I've been working in the city and working on this project. But we've realized that it's a pretty great thing for other cities as well. So the Map Room platform, all the hardware and all the software, first of all, but also all of the curricula that we use in the schools, the kind of the letters that we write to community groups, the ways that we approach people, that the way we made it happen is all going to be open sourced. So another city can do their own Map Room. So there could be a Flint Map Room or a Mexico City Map Room. And then the last thing I hope, and this is the grand utopian hope of it all, is that enough people get into this space and talk about issues and that those conversations lead to some real change in the city and that we I hope we open the floodgates a little bit about people talking about this, not only in our space but over their dinner table and at their schools and at their offices, and it becomes a public time for people to talk about this thing.
So you've mentioned that the project will help us learn more about some real issues that are affecting people, income, race, you know, you mentioned the route to school. What's something specific that people could look for as part of this project that you think might surprise them?
Oh, that's a great question. And again, I want to do this interview after again in some ways because I don't know the answer to that really. If we did, I think the project would be less interesting because we'd be like, hey, we want you to learn this specific thing and we would kind of craft around that. But part of this also is about the fact, and I'll go back to what I said earlier, that there are very few people that kind of have the technical know-how and data and geographic literacy to be even working with these data sets. And I hope that by having hundreds and hundreds and thousands of other people doing it, that you simply will find things that other people don't have the time to find. And I love city planners, and I love all these civic minded professionals, and they all want to discover new stories and new issues and new things. But this is a big city. These data sets are enormous. There just simply isn't time for five people to find all the interesting things. And so in a way, this is like mobilizing an army to dig through this stuff and to find little nooks and crannies in the data that for whatever reason wouldn't be seen.
Is there something so far that St. Louis has surprised you with, or that even in just your leading up to the launch of this has you've been surprised by, either in the data or just in being here?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I knew nothing about St. Louis. Like literally, I mean, I knew the basics of it, that it was on the Mississippi and it was a city. And I'm Canadian, so I also knew there was a hockey team. And so my understanding of St. Louis was that area that you can see from the helicopter as they shot the aerial shots of the arena. Like that was kind of it. And one of the reasons that I was actually said yes to this project was that reason. It was like, okay, I know nothing about this city. Let's see what's going on. And I you know, the direct answer to your question is about the divided geography of the city. So you know, the Del Mar Divide and how I've been thinking a lot in the lead up to this project of this moment that happened in history where somebody with a ruler with a straight edge drew that line. I don't know who that was, but it took them all 10 seconds. And that 10 seconds has changed this city fundamentally. And so that was really amazing to me. And then people would be like, oh, well, have you heard about our ward system or how many mayors we have and so on and so on. And it is like stacked on top of itself. There's a really interesting story in this city. Of course, it's an easy thing to say any city is defined by the kind of maps that have been drawn. But this one, much more than others, is defined by boundaries. Some of them real and most of them not real. Most of them literally just like imaginary lines that were drawn on a map. And that starts with like the sort of city grid, and it goes through the redlining maps and you know, continues today as we think about like what was that future of that city county divide, and with new developments coming into the North City, and we're still thinking about boundaries. I had a chance to go up to the top of a bell tower of a cathedral yesterday, so more than 100 feet up, and look out over the city. And there's a real patchwork of divisions between neighborhoods, between blocks, between roads. There's concrete dividers in the middle of streets. It is something that for this city, I think it is core to its identity.
So you've mentioned those sort of invented divides and imaginary lines. We also have real physical ones. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, the Mississippi River is dividing the bi-state area, and that's a real physical thing that you can look at. Do you have any thoughts about how that might be different or similar to the imaginary ones?
Yeah, and I think there are more. You know, there are more things that are actually real lines. The freeway system, I think, is the most obvious one. That does you just can't walk across it. You know, you can in a couple of locations. Boundaries are not a bad thing. The river is the reason why this city is here, and so we want to also offer people a chance to understand that. One of my favorite maps of the city was a hand-drawn map from a resident of the city in 1877, and she was asked to sort of draw from memory what the city looked like. The city, I'm putting that in air quotes, because there were like 11 buildings. But it's really interesting to see that, because the very, very first thing that she would have drawn on that map is that curve of the river. And so even way back then, that line was really important to the city. But I love that contrast between that line, that organic, smooth, like the result of millennia of erosion. Like that line feels very human, whereas that Delmar line I talked about is not. It feels more violent. It's like a cut. It's something very different than that. And then, you know, there are other ones that used to exist that were erased. You know, there were lots of rivers and streams that flowed through the city at one point that were paved over and redirected into culverts and underneath the city. So there's that too, right? Like the city has been affected by boundaries that have been made. It's also been affected by boundaries that have been erased.
So people will get the chance to draw their own maps at this in this map room. Can you sort of paint a picture for us and tell us what it will look like when somebody comes into this space? What will they see when they arrive?
Well, I don't want to steal too much of the thunder because I want people to come and see. But we have these very large mapping platforms that we take their blank maps, which are 10 feet by 10 feet. That's a big map. And we have these I call them cute because I like to anthropomorphize technology. They're cute. These little drawing robots that will draw the kind of base of your map. So major roads, the river if the river's on there, the park if the park happens to be on there. You can zoom into any part of the city like you can do with Google Maps and kind of pick the location you want. And then that these robots kind of go off and draw. And if you're there to make a map with your group, whether that's a group of coworkers or a community group you might be involved with or a school that you go to, you'll have some time to talk about, like, what are you going to do and what kind of materials are you going to use and what's the story that you really want to tell. And then over the course of a couple of hours, you make the map, and it's a very physical process. You're like, you got to kind of get down on your hands and knees and draw. It feels like you're a miniature person on this really, really large map. And then when you're done drawing the map, that acts as a surface to project all these data layers on it. You might want to start with a data layer about access to daycare services, for example. Project that on top of your map and say, oh, that's interesting. Like, this area has less access to daycare services than this one does. And I can see now how my life and my routes and the places that I'm interested in, sort of how they settle into that system. But, you know, I think at the end we'll probably have about 30 different data layers, so you'll be able to page through them and kind of figure it out. And then one of my favorite parts about it is we wanted to give people a chance to compare different data layers. So we have these flashlights that beam ultraviolet light, and the computer up on the ceiling can see that light, but you can't, and it'll fill that light with another map. So I might be looking at that daycare map, and then I can use the flashlight to show income levels, and I can compare those two things. And that's, again, we want to give people the chance to, like, pass that flashlight around and ask some questions and say, oh, well, why don't we compare this and this? Like, why don't we compare these two things? And then that's like, even if you're not making a map, and making a map takes quite a long time with all the discussion and just the physicality of it. It's like a 4-hour process, essentially. If you're not making a map and you just want to come visit the space, then you can pass around that flashlight and do some exploration. And, like, maybe you pull down that map from the school kids, or maybe you pull down a map that was made by paramedics or sanitation workers or botanists, and you get a different lens on the city than maybe you have as an individual.
How do you actually put that layer of data over the map? How does that work?
Sure. So that's both the easy and the hard part. So you know, we were lucky for some of our data sets in that the data is already, like, really geographical data. And that means that we're using an open source mapping platform, and we can just drop the data on the map, and it already zooms and pans, and we're kind of there. Where it becomes harder is things with, like, historical maps. So historical maps are often, like, really beautiful, but they're not on the same grid that a Google map is. So we have to go through a process which is called rectifying. We gotta take that map and, like, make it into the proper rectangle. And we're doing that using a great tool that the New York Public Library's research and development team created. And that allows us to literally take any map and stretch it on to fit perfectly onto the grid. And so that process has been really interesting. We're, like, looking at maps from the Mercantile Museum and from the city archives and also some publicly available ones to kind of stitch them together. And so that's another thing I'm really proud of about this proud of this project is that it'll result in a lot of new, really easy-to-use maps that kind of anybody can explore.
That's lead designer and digital artist Jared Thorpe, who, along with COCA, the Center of Creative Arts, is putting on a new project called the St. Louis Map Room. Thorpe talked with St. Louis Public Radio's data visual specialist Brent Jones. The St. Louis Map Room begins March the 3rd and runs through April the 9th, taking place in the gymnasium of a vacant school in the city. Community members and school children, in partnership with St. Louis Public Schools, are invited to create their own maps. For information, visit stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. And speaking of school, let's go out with a Sesame Street educational classic from Big Bird and Snuffleupagus.
When there's some place you want to be, but you're not quite sure where you're going.
Oh, yeah.
It's so easy to look and see on a map.
This way.
On a map. If we're here, I'll bet that great big square is the school right across the street. And beside it on our map right there is the bike shop.
Wow, this is neat.
Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. I'm Steve Potter. Thanks for listening.